This week on Behind the Lens, Phase 1 begins in the city of New Orleans as state restrictions ease up, but employers and workers both have to make some tough choices. We'll hear from one restaurant worker who was able to make that choice. Others have few options, if any. We'll hear from businessman and former lawmaker Conrad Appel in this hour. Also, an inmate dies of COVID-19 at Oakdale Prison several weeks after he was approved for early release. Henderson Lewis gets a contract extension at OPSB after all. And vocalist Emeka Divya on survival and stardom amid the pandemic. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by Community Support. Learn more at thelensnoaa.org/donate. We welcome listeners on our partner radio stations, 90.3 FM WAMF LP and 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. At 6 a.m. Saturday, New Orleanians begin Phase 1 of the city's planned reopening. The growth in COVID-19 cases here is down, but it remains a threat in NOLA and beyond. And now a long struggle begins to recover from the pandemic's economic impact. Michael Isaacstein begins our coverage.
Phase 1 of the city's reopening plan starts on Saturday. It's called Phase 1 Safest at Home. And as you can kind of guess from the title here, this first phase is not kind of a call for everybody to go back out and resume their normal lives. A lot of the restrictions, the individual restrictions, the staying at home that people have gotten used to over the past couple of months are staying in place. However, there are some things that are changing. There are certain businesses that have been closed since the beginning of this crisis that are now reopening under limited circumstances. So under the plan, we're looking at retail stores, gyms, nail salons, museums, movie theaters, houses of worship are now going to be able to open their doors, albeit at 25% of their normal capacity. There are some differences between the city and state plan. For the most part, the city is following its suit with the state's reopening plan, which actually began today. We're speaking on Friday, so a day before the city's plan. Maybe one key difference between the state's plan and the city's plan is that while the state allows casinos to open, the city is keeping those closed until future phased reopenings.
Michael, it's not as if businesses are required technically to reopen, and an awful lot of businesses are now faced with a very difficult choice, aren't there?
Yeah, and yeah, you hit on a good point here. Just because these businesses can open doesn't mean they will, and there's a lot of considerations there. One of the obvious one being safety, the other one being is it even worth it for a restaurant to open at 25% capacity of will they even make enough money to pay for that staff and the cleaning and so forth, especially given the extra cleaning protocols you have to go through. So these are kind of individual decisions, and we still don't know yet just how many stores are going to open, come Saturday. Again, it's weighing whether it's worth it, whether your employees want to do it. And obviously the decisions that each business makes is going to greatly affect the employees, at that individual business.
And certainly the workers themselves, the employees of these businesses have some difficult choices to make themselves, don't they?
Yeah, and some people see it as a difficult choice. Others are, saying they don't have a choice at all. As these businesses reopen, people are being invited back to work. And they're now facing this kind of dilemma where, on the one hand, there's their, there's personal safety. Because let's remember, just because we're reopening, no one is under the illusion that the virus is gone. We still report new cases every day. It's dramatically lower than we were at the peak of this crisis back in early April. But there's really no saying what's going to happen once this reopening, begins. So workers are dealing with that uncertainty. At the same time, there are questions about how business reopenings are going to affect the unemployment benefits for their workers, right? So if a business reopens and invites an employee to come back to work, If that employee, let's just say they're immunocompromised or they live at home with someone who's vulnerable to the virus, if they reject the invitation to come back to work, they could put themselves at risk of losing their unemployment benefits, which would really leave people with neither a job or government benefits and really no way to kind of meet daily costs. And the last thing I'll say is kind of to make the matters worse here is that there's just a lot of uncertainty both on the safety end and on how unemployment benefits are going to be handled. It's still unclear, whether someone is allowed to not go into work because of they're afraid of the virus and remain on unemployment. We talked to the Louisiana Workforce Commission, who is ultimately in charge of that decision, and they basically said it'll come down to a case-by-case basis, but we weren't really able to get much more details. And from what we were hearing from workers, they aren't either. So, they're not only tough decisions, but they're decisions being made in a very fluid situation with a lot of unknown. So not an easy position whatsoever.
Absolutely. And Michael, as you mentioned, we're speaking on Friday afternoon, shortly before 2. The mayor is about to give an update to media, and I know you need to bolt away. But I want to thank you again for excellent reporting on the city beat. Michael Isaac Stein, thank you, my friend, and stay safe.
Appreciate you, Tom.
One of those workers Michael was talking about is Jessie Musinski. She's a restaurant service professional who is taking a break from the profession and the risk of contracting the virus at work. We spoke with Jessie earlier this year, and we checked in this week for an update.
Work-wise, personally, I've stopped working. I was working 3 days a week, about 30 hours, and I've now stepped back. It was a little bit before the reopening, which comes this Friday, with the conversation being that this gives the restaurant's ownership time to bring back other employees and get them in the swing of things. And so I am now fully unemployed. I am fully collecting unemployment, both the $600 federal bonus as well as the $247 maximum from the state of Louisiana.
It sounds like you were able to make a choice, thankfully.
Yes, and I'm very lucky that the ownership of the restaurant I was working at are considerate and kind, whole human beings who consider it of their staff everything. So I sat down and had a talk with the owner, and right after the mayor's new plans for the phase one reopening of the city of New Orleans, the owner of this is understandably very excited to reopen and make money. This particular business has a large outdoor seating area, so the new regulations are going to work out pretty well for them. They're also a more neighborhood place, not a tourist place. Again, so things will work out well for them. But I was able to sit down and talk to the owner and tell him how I'm not ready for this. I'm not ready personally to be in a situation where I'm around that many people unmasked. This restaurant, with the parameters set up by the city, can still have 70 to 80 people in it. And that's too many people for me to be around without having them in face masks, which they can't be in face masks if they're going to be eating and drinking. So I was honest. I told him my fears and they understood.
Do you feel like a lot of your counterparts at other restaurants, friends, associates, are making that same decision or would like to be able to make that decision?
I absolutely think they would like to be able to make this decision. I don't think that many of them are offered. And obviously there's exceptions out there, like my exception. For the greater picture, I see a lot of comments on Facebook from friends in the industry, New Orleans Hospitality and Tourism Group, where people are just at wit's end. They don't know what to do. The unemployment has been flawless for everybody. I'm lucky claimed unemployment before in the state of Louisiana. So it was easy for me to just like log back in. And but a lot of people haven't gotten any compensation yet. So they're definitely at a point where they may not want to go back to work. They may not feel safe going back to work, but they feel like they have to work. This was really interesting to me, and I think it could be pertinent to your podcast. Ohio has made it so you can keep collecting unemployment if you don't feel safe going back to work. Because the way the Louisiana law is written, you can refuse to go back to work and stay on unemployment if you've been exposed, if you're sick, if you've been solidly exposed, if you live in the house with somebody where you're a caretaker and they're immunocompressed, or things like that. But just you wanting to stay safe and stay alive is not a good enough thing for you to do on Louisiana unemployment.
Let me just ask you what you envision, you know, from an experienced perspective, industry speaking, 25% occupancy for dine-in, outdoor seating. What does it look like to you?
I don't know. 25% capacity seating in an indoor dining room is not going to be enough money for a business to continue. Restaurant margins are razor thin. And in New Orleans, you learn how to deal with your ebbs and flows because you make so much money, you know, at Jazz Fest and French Quarter Fest and things like that. And so over the summer, July, August, September, when there's nothing, that's how you pay it back. The best case scenario right now seems to be 25% capacity July, August, September. And I don't understand how any business is going to be able to run and pay their bills. The PPP has come out. And so once you get the PPP, what I was told was that you have 3 months from the date it issued to use it. So everybody's getting their PPPs now. So we'll say May, June, July, August, and September. We're talking prime hurricane season. Nobody's coming to town. The restaurants are going to be out of loan. I don't know what's happening. As far as actually thinking about when service back and dining, I've been thinking about this because I'm trying to think about what will need to happen for me to willingly go back to work, to serving people, waiting on people, bartending. And I think it's really going to need to be increased testing, this whole 50 tests per spot per day. I know that I'm not going out to get those tests because I'm not going to run across town at 8 a.m. to pull up. And it's not like I need to be able to have a test, like lickety split, no problem. And that's how everybody needs. So we need like definitely increased testing. But the restaurant industry never depended on healthy workers. The restaurant industry depends very heavily on sick workers going up to work.
Sick workers who don't have any choice.
As you go out to restaurants at this time where they're not testing, where the employees don't have health insurance, where they feel like they need to work to live, even if they're scared about contracting coronavirus. So you're going to go into those places. And yes, on some level, are you giving money to these restaurants and supporting them? 100%. But you're also going into these places with the population of workers that are not only are like emotionally in a bad space, but very easy to have somebody who's asymptomatic work at the restaurant face to face with you.
Do you think that is recognized by the majority of restaurant goers?
No, I don't think, and I don't think this is a bad thing. I don't think it's, you know, out of malice that they don't understand these things, because when you go to a restaurant and it's being run properly, you don't notice anything. When you go to a restaurant and it's being run properly, the refill to your soda is there as you open your mouth to ask for it. Like there's a lot of, we're setting a scene and letting people enjoy their dinner, lunch, brunch, whatever. So you try to keep them out of it. They're there with the person that they're there with, and that's all that they're worried about. I think that the majority of people across the country don't really understand what restaurants are like to work in.
Jesse Mazinski, thank you so much. Best of luck to you, and keep us posted here.
Thank you.
You can follow Jesse on Twitter by the handle Sweet Babette. Another Louisianan you're bound to run across on Twitter is Conrad Appel. He's the owner of Construction South and a former Republican legislator for Citizens in Jefferson Parish. We asked for Mr. Appel's perspective on the economy and politics in the state capital.
Let me ask you first, Mr. Appel, I presume you and your family are in good health and doing well.
We are. Thank you very much. We've all been laying low, and my kids are gone. One lives in San Francisco, and one lives in Washington, D.C., and they're sequestered to their apartments for some weeks now. So, yeah, we're
sure. We are, of course, this week looking at the prospect of essentially opening shop in a lot of ways here in Louisiana, not completely, but loosening some of the restrictions that we've been under for several weeks now. What is your opinion of the timing?
You know, I've been very careful not to criticize the governor or the mayor. They have a very unenviable position to be in. Clearly, we have a two-headed snake. We had the medical side, obviously, that's terrible and still going on, and who knows how much longer it'll go on. But then we had the economic side, too, which at the end of the day may actually be worse for our people, the majority of our people, than the medical side was. So I'm not sure you can say one was worse over the other. They were based, my definition of worse is based off of two different snakes.
Sure.
I started out in 1973 from college and started working. Well, between 1973 and 80, the New Orleans economy was just blowing and going. I mean, we had 650,000 people.
Uh-huh.
New Orleans East was built in Metairie, all of that city and all of Metairie built up. The whole economy was going, and it had three main and maybe one or two subcategories. The main ones were the port, oil and gas,
sure,
tourism. Tourism was very small back then. Was tiny. Back in the 80s,
uh-huh,
the French Quarter was junk. It was a warehouse district.
Right.
You could buy property for nothing. The subsidiary ones were perhaps the aerospace, which was out of Nishu when we were building the moon rockets and everything.
Sure.
And then also the we were a regional headquarters for a lot of corporations, insurance companies, things like that. So we had big banks, three major banks that were international in scope. We had, during that period of time, all those high rises you see downtown were built. The Superdome was built, later the convention center. So, I mean, we were really prosperous. Then it comes 1980 and there was an oil crisis. And from 1980 to 1990, the city collapsed economically.
Mm-hmm.
And the population decreased to about, I can't remember, 350 maybe, 400. We lost all the oil and gas exploration stuff, all of it, and all the support businesses. The port had become highly mechanized, so when there was 3,000 or 4,000 stevedores working at the port, suddenly there was 300 or 400. Were really good middle-class jobs. They paid a lot. So in that 10-year span, it took New Orleans 10 years to recover from that rough patch in around 80. And when we did recover, we were a whole lot smaller city. From 80 to 90, things were pretty strong, probably all the way up to Katrina. And we were doing pretty good. You know, we lost most of our corporate business. And if you recall, we had an area called the Business District that used to be business. It's now residential. Fast forward to today, actually to pre-COVID days, we were a city that was just about wholly dependent on tourism. We had lost our big banks. Matter of fact, we don't even have a big bank anymore. We have the, you know, some sub-headquarters of banks that aren't even here.
Sure.
And so we had kind of dropped to a second-tier city, and then COVID comes along, and you know, school's out on that, but I'm afraid we're going to lose, you know, we've lost 25 for employment after we were 2 days ago. And I'm afraid it's not going to come back very quickly. I don't think anybody thinks it is. So now suddenly we're going to be a city that had basically one industry, and that industry is crippled for an indeterminate amount of time. Using that, that's what I use as my background because I live it. And then at the state level, we have a very similar situation because New Orleans was the heartbeat of the state 30 years ago. It was the economic driver 30, 40 years ago. And then it slowly became just another city. And then oil and gas, you know, was always very strong, but that has diminished. And now with the Arab, the war between Russia, the price war,
right,
Arabs, we may not have an oil and gas exploration piece left, or if we do, it'll be greatly diminished.
That is awfully concerning when I remember a conversation you and I had many moons ago just about legislative budget making and what it took to really keep the book balanced.
So now you got the southern half of the state. I mean, we actually did for a period of about 10 years up in the northwest had a booming oil and gas exploration play.
Right.
That died out about 4 or 5 years ago, though. And that was not killed by this process. It's that's been gone for a while. That was a shooting area. So now all of a sudden we have a state whose major industries left, major job creators left. And I'm talking about major ones, not the subsidiary stuff, is the petrochemical strip, which is mainly from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, some over in Lake Charles. We have a port that was really strong. Remember, I was chairman of the board of the port, so I'm prejudiced a little bit. But we have the largest port complex between, if you count between the mouth of the river and Baton Rouge, it's the largest port complex in the Western Hemisphere. And it's still fairly prosperous, but it doesn't produce the jobs it used to. I used to go with my dad. We were probably the oldest construction company in Louisiana. It's an electrical company, but it was always unionized. So I used to hang out with my dad when I was young at the Stevedores Hall. They used to have a big Christmas party. One, there was a black one on stage on Claiborne, and then a white one, if it was on Louisiana Avenue or something. But, and then they merged the two. That was in the late 60s, early 70s. But there were thousands of stevedores. And they were, like I say, that was a gateway for a lot of people that didn't necessarily have an education to get to the middle class in our area. Not anybody's fault, but containers came along and then put the break bulk business out. And we still have some of it, but nothing like we had back then. So now we have a city that's got a very dim future, as far as anybody can see, it's very dim. Could change tomorrow, who knows, but I doubt it. And then we've got a state who's got a budget that just blew up. I guess you followed the studies that came out, the REC meeting 2 days ago. So there's like $1 billion hole, roughly. I think it was 800 something million, but blown into it. Now that 800 something million dollar shortfall is, you gotta break down to the basics of that. Before COVID, we were gonna have, don't hold me to this number, but I wanna say it was $300 million surplus year to year from that budget to what was today's budget, which is 1920, year 2019 through 20. And then suddenly, when COVID came along, the bottom fell out of that one, so the $300 million disappeared, and there's a small negative, 100, 125 maybe, year over year. That's assuming you spent what you spent in the 2018 and 19 budget. So that's, when they say we have $125 million shortfall, it's really comparing year before to this year.
Right.
And then now, suddenly, we're going forward to the 20, you're gotta be careful, 2020 to 2021 budget. That's the one that's got an $850 million shortfall.
Uh-huh. And that's, yeah. That's the one that the lawmakers have to balance, essentially.
By the 1st of July. So, but remember, though, that is based on a baseline of spending. There's 850 short. So they can balance that budget in really three ways. One would be federal money that may or may not come. So put that on the side. Two would be a reduction of spending. Three would be an increase of taxes. It will end up, by the way, be a mix. I don't think there'll be any taxes. You cannot raise taxes in the face of unemployment like we have. You just cause this catastrophe in the employment department. There'll be a mix of federal money, a little bit of a rainy day fund, but they can only use about $150 million of that. And then federal money, some rainy day money. There was a $200 million change in what they call the FMAP for Medicaid,
which
was in our favor. So that'll be put into that mix. And then, of course, adjustments in spending.
You're certainly well aware of the tight parameters within which a legislature must balance a budget. By law, they have to.
Yeah, first, by the end of the fiscal year, which is June 30th.
The podcast last week, we had a couple of people you're probably familiar with, Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, Mary Lee Orr, both noted environmental activists here, Mary Lee Orr with the Louisiana Environmental Action Network.
Yeah.
The foremost complaint from that corner, if you will, was that the legislature, given the severity of the pandemic, the risks to lawmakers themselves, given those circumstances, they demanded that lawmakers focus on the bare essentials of legislation, focused on the budget primarily.
I have a totally different perspective, and I, having lived through Katrina, it was extraordinarily important that the legislature convene at once to address the economic disaster that was Katrina. And I'm not talking about the damage from the winds. I'm talking about the shutdown of businesses, loss of jobs, loss of income, families that were displaced, and all of that. I take the same view of this session. We've lost at least 350,000 jobs in Louisiana. We have 25% unemployment in New Orleans. Remember I talked about a dual-headed snake.
Right.
I take the perspective that the people in the legislature, matter of fact, I got in a big fight on Twitter about it, but my perspective is these 144 folks, 143 because one actually died, are the brains and mouthpieces for 4.5 million people in our state. And for them not to be working on issues that are critical to the people is just the wrong approach. I absolutely believe they should take whatever safety precautions are fair, but... listen, I've spent the whole day listening to the debate. There's two bills up today on tort reform.
Right.
You know, I'm sure those two folks who called in last week or talked to you last week would say that's not a non-critical thing. We've got 350,000 people out of work. We've got a city that has no economy. Things like tort reform are the keys to restarting an economy. So it's extraordinarily important that that legislature address those issues. Now, I'm not saying they should worry about renaming bridges and picking the state butterfly. That's goofy stuff. And actually, my experience was about half of the bills we had.
I've been to the Fed. I understand.
Yeah, you do.
Conrad Appel, a former lawmaker with the Louisiana State Legislature and owner, proprietor of Construction South. Thank you again. I really appreciate your time today.
It's my pleasure.
You're listening to Behind the Lens on podcast app, our website, or one of our partner radio stations, 102.3 FM WHIVLP and 90.3 FM WAMFLP, New Orleans. After a short break, Marta Jusen with the latest on mysterious leadership moves by city educators, and we'll talk with the Mecca Divya about his collaborative work with the Brassaholics. Back in a bit.
I'm Karen Gadbois, founder and director at The Lens. We're committed to covering the COVID-19 crisis here in South Louisiana. The business of journalism is important and crucial, and all our staff is working hard to bring you accurate and vital reporting. But we can't do this work without your continued support for nonprofit needs. Learn about ways you can help us keep the lights on at our website, thelensnola.org/donate. And remember, stay home, stay informed. We thank you.
Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens, NOLA.org. I'm Tom Wright, and this next story has been a tough one to learn about for many of us, reporters and readers alike. We're talking about the death of a federal inmate at a prison here in South Louisiana. That COVID-19 related death has raised yet more questions about jailers' ability to respond to the pandemic. Nick Krestel reports.
George Escamilla was a 67-year-old diabetic. He was a double amputee in a wheelchair, and he was being held at the Oakdale Federal Prison in Louisiana on a drug charge. He had served about 12 years of a 16-year sentence. But back in mid-March, he found out that he was going to be released to home confinement. And this was presumably due to the pandemic. He found that out in mid-March, and he called his son to have his son prepare his home where George was going to be staying. And then someone from a halfway house actually visited his son's home to make sure that it was an acceptable place for George to be staying. And George was given a release date of May 6th, between mid-March and early April, and May 6th, there was a coronavirus outbreak in the Oakdale prison. And George on April 15th, he contracted the virus and he went into respiratory failure and was sent to the hospital. And he was there for about 3 weeks until he died on May 8th, which was 2 days after the date that he was scheduled to be released.
Let me get this clear. Let me get this straight. The arrangements for his release began mid-March. He died on May 8th. What on earth caused this delay?
It's a very good question and one that I don't have an answer to. You know, it was becoming very clear by the end of March that the prison had a very serious coronavirus outbreak. It has been one of the worst in the federal prison system that has seen plenty of them. And you know, in early April, Attorney General William Barr wrote a memo to the department or to the Bureau of Prisons, mandating and specifically mentioning Oakdale that they should be releasing prisoners who have been approved for home confinement immediately. Those were the words he used. And, you know, it was, and ostensibly, Escamilla had been approved, but he was not immediately released. And he stayed in the prison until April 15th, when he contracted the virus and then eventually passed away from it.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like you're getting a lot of answers right now from the Bureau of Prisons. What about his family? What about his legal counsel, for that matter?
His family, I talked to two of his sons, including the one who was going to be, who George was going to be living with when he got out. And they're devastated and hold the prison responsible for not moving quicker to release their father. I did talk to a lawyer. There was a lawyer who was actually initially unaware of the fact that Escamilla was being scheduled for release. He was applying to get Escamilla compassionate release. And this was already after, he had been diagnosed with the virus. So that legal, claim basically came to an end when Escamilla died. So they're really not getting any answers from the Bureau of Prisons either. And you know, it'll be interesting to see. I don't know if they're considering, if the family is considering any legal action against the Bureau. It's not something I discussed with them, and I'm not sure that it's something that they're thinking about yet, but they certainly do hold them responsible for their father's death.
Nick, I know you'll be keeping an eye on that as well as the broader picture with the federal and state prison systems. Meantime, I understand there's a bit of a development at New Orleans Criminal Court.
Yeah, so last week, a few plea deals took place via video conference at the New Orleans Criminal District Court, which is something that hasn't been going on since the court closed back in mid-March. And that is a product both of them, I think, figuring out logistically how to do it, in order for a legal plea deal to take place. The defendant needs to be being legally advised by counsel. They need to sign some paperwork and fingerprint, something. So trying to figure that out during this pandemic was a challenge. A number of these defendants were in jail, so it was hard to get them set up for a video conference. But they were able to figure it out, and last week they started doing these. The other thing is that the public defenders in the first weeks of the pandemic were really focused on trying to get as many people out of jail as possible, which meant filing lots of bond reduction motions, and, you know, arguing to convince judges to let their clients out in the face of the pandemic. And that sort of work, I think, has sort of plateaued a little bit. They said that now this needs to be negotiating with the district attorney's office and trying to get some of these charges reduced or find a way to negotiate a deal for some of these people who are still in jail.
Nick, thank you very much. Nick Krassel on the criminal justice beat for The Lens. Have a good one, Nick.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tom.
In education news, second time was the charm for Orleans Parish School Board members who wanted to extend their superintendent's contract. This week, they approved a controversial extension for Dr. Henderson Lewis, even as the district waits to gauge its financial losses amid the pandemic. Here's Marta Jusen.
At Thursday night's board meeting, which was held virtually, of course, the board was able to push through an extension for 1 year on Superintendent Lewis's contract. He gets an annual salary of $250,000. So there was some debate over, you know, whether or not this should be happening right now, especially with the uncertain financial future for the district and, you know, poor financial forecasts since our sales tax revenue is going down. But that extension passed 5-2, even after a series of motions and questions and, you know, the confusing virtual context that went through in the end.
And just to be clear, the last time we talked about this this effort, there was a heck of a lot of public input, even within the virtual meeting space, compared to this time.
Right. And so those same people didn't show up this time. It was kind of a different crowd. There were five people who commented four were in support of the extension. I'm not really sure what happened to that serious opposition that was present at the meeting last time.
Did it seem to be clear that this vote would take place? Did they have any idea it was taking place?
I would say it was certainly less than clear. The board had the same very vague action item on its agenda again, which just said that they would give the board attorney power to change the contract in any way needed. Which, you know, nowhere in there did it say extension or 1 year or details like that. That you know, since they made this exact same attempt again, you'd think maybe those details would have been in the initial action item on the agenda.
Yeah, well, you would think. I know there are still a heck of a lot of questions about the why of this move, but what at least can you tell people about the timing? You know, what's the context here?
The big push from this came from some of the board members to do this right now because of the COVID crisis and wanted to keep leadership the same. However, his contract doesn't run out until June of 2021. So leadership is the same for the next year. And that's what two board members were. That was their argument, was that, you know, we have stable leadership right now. Why should we do this now? Another factor in there is that a new board is going to be elected in the fall and will take their seats in January. Some board members argue that that new board's first task shouldn't be finding a new superintendent. But, you know, they're also kind of making that decision preemptively for that new board, whoever they may be.
Interesting stuff, and certainly something school parents will be wondering and awaiting answers to some of their questions. And thankful to you, Marta Jusen, for keeping us on point, as always, on the education beat. Thank you, Marta.
Thank you.
This week, we continue our series on local musicians struggling amid the COVID-19 closures. Emeka Divya is no stranger to this podcaster. I happened to work with him for a few years at Fox 8 News before he took a much more creative tack in his career. I spoke with him, along with another former co-worker, Antje Johnson, now writing for our partners at NewOrleansLocal.com.
I really loved my time at Fox 8. I learned a lot, but it just got to a point that I felt like it wasn't, I wanted to do something new, and I did something new. And I enjoy what I do, even though it was a rocky start. I did not make enough money to cover my bills. And going through that process, I started teaching, and I found that that is actually something I love as well. So now I'm doing literally the best of both worlds. I've always wanted to do music, journalism, and I always saw myself in the end game doing teaching. But now I'm doing all three. So I'm doing freelance journalism, I'm singing with the Brassaholics, and I'm doing my own gigs. And also I am teaching at Booker T. Washington as a vocal music instructor. So I'm living my dream.
The hardest thing for you after leaving Quark's Aid, well, obviously the money thing, but like what was the most difficult? Was it more difficult to break into music?
Actually, my music experience was actually rather, I don't want to say easy, but compared to like other singers, I did really well. Like after my first year, even though the first couple of months, even the first year was really hard. I mean, after my first year and a half, I already was doing like jazz fests and major festivals in the city. So usually it takes, you know, singers in the city a while to get to that time. But for me, I'll say a year and a half. And within a year and a half, I was already doing festivals.
So you're from here and you already had the connections basically. Is that part of it? And I know you had already been singing even while you're
I actually, in that case, I actually did not use any connections to get there. What I started doing in that 2016 years, I dedicated every month, every week, I dedicated to doing an open mic. So that's how I kind of got my name out there in the music arena. And I got picked up by this reggae band, Higher Heights, and their lead singer was going on maternity leave. Well, she went on maternity leave and never came back. So I took all of the gigs that they did. So they did Jazz Fest, French Quarter Fest, and they performed on Frenchman Street every weekend. So that's kind of like was my start.
What's your preferred style and what kind of styles are you actually working? What are your working styles as opposed to what you really love to sing?
So this is like I feel like I'm going through an experimental phase. So I've started out singing church music and gospel, but also, you know, like the rarity of New Orleans, there are a lot of Black Catholics. So I grew up Catholic and in a African-American kind of like environment, so I was versed with the classical music. So a lot of stuff that we do, recitatives and responsorial songs, you kind of have to be versed in that as well. So I've kind of got a best of both worlds in that aspect. College, I had a music minor for a little while and I studied classical voice. And then I got into, it was the R&B, and then it was reggae. And when I got the Higher Heights gig, I had never sung reggae in my life. I mean, I knew a couple of Bob Marley tunes, but that was it. It was like, I was not a hardcore roots rock reggae guy. And now I'm really diving into jazz. So I'm really, it's actually something I'm passionate about, because we live in New Orleans, we live in the birthplace of jazz, but as a music teacher, it's something that we don't teach. Like I was looking up, who was it? It was like James Booker or Buddy Bolden. And these are names who are you know, jazz legends. And if you go to places like Chicago, you know, people know these people. But as a lifelong resident of New Orleans or the New Orleans area, I've never studied those people until now. So I'm really trying to kind of get into more knowledge of the jazz and the history of New Orleans as an educator and also as a vocalist. But now I am all over the place. I am doing reggae a little bit. Well, I'm not doing reggae as much as I used to do, but my main thing right now is gospel, of course, in church, R&B, jazz with the Brazzaholics, and now I'm actually looking into Afrobeat. I'm a half Nigerian. My dad was Nigerian. So I'm really looking into Afrobeat and African music.
In terms of New Orleans culture, it's surprising, and it may well be surprising to others, but it's surprising to me that we don't have a greater emphasis on musical education in a city like New Orleans, which, of course, you're helping to take care of, I know, as in your role as teacher.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you have programs that started, implementing that because I guess after Hurricane Katrina, well, obviously after Hurricane Katrina, most of the arts programs were cut because, you know, you need to focus on education after the storm and recovery school district or whatever. But there are programs like Roots of Music who are formed with, you know, the Rebirth Brass Band members to help kind of like move the culture forward. But these are only a few tools that our students and our kids have access to. So I would be, I would like to see the Orleans Parish School Board or New Orleans community in general just take hold to more of the arts. My music teacher, I've been playing piano since I was 5, and she's been at McDonald 35 as a vocal music teacher there as well for 39 years. She makes 40 years next year. And she says, you know, it's sad right now. Like, it's like we almost don't value the jewel that New Orleans is with our music and our art.
Talk about live performance. I mean, it's great to be in New Orleans where you can book multiple performances at multiple venues mm-hmm. every week in the best of times. We're not in the best of times, obviously.
Correct.
So talk to us about what sort of impact the bar and club closures have had on, you know, that part of your work and your life.
So now, you know, gigs on the weekend are basically non-existent, but I personally have been requested to sing at different virtual events. So the Brassaholics actually did a show at the House of Blues 2 weeks ago, a virtual show at the House of Blues. So it was good. It was good production, but we didn't make that much money. So it's... it's just dealing with that, the new environment of trying to navigate putting out art, putting out your art firm, but also it being profitable. I also, not too long ago, did like a virtual party for one of my friends. And so the new thing is now I have to invest in equipment. I have to get mics and I live stream. And I thank God for my background in, you know, news, because I kind of have a grasp on what to get. Or even how to, you know, write and phrase what I want to write to submit to people so it can possibly get picked up. But yeah, it's just an interesting new world. But I will say, before Corona, musicians were complaining about how, you know, revenue or tips had significantly decreased from the French Quarter to Frenchman Street. And I think part of it was musicians not getting to the times, not adapting to the times, because now I don't carry cash. So how am I gonna pass around a tip jar and I don't even have cash? So some bands were innovative and started, you know, giving out their cash apps and selling merchandise. But I think that would forward that effort even more. But I will say, I do predict, like, moving forward, that music, live music in New Orleans is not going to be cheap. Not at all. I can see, especially with the new mandates and you have to be 6 feet apart, I wouldn't be surprised if you go to a club and they're trying to charge like $50 a head, because it, we, like one of my friends said the other day, we've become almost like one of the non-essential jobs to being technically essential, because people are yearning for connection in our music right now. So I see when those clubs and venues open a tax on them, and it might not be available to those who don't have means.
You want to talk about NPR and the video report that they put together with about you and the Brassaholics and what that?
Yeah, so actually we went viral twice with that. So first, Sam Winstrom of WWL did a web story on I'll Fly Away, and I believe it took legs from there. After that, we had about 50,000 views, and then we got the NPR thing. So it was kind of like a double whammy. It happened because one of the band members, actually the band leader, Winston Turner, he received news that one of his friends lost his mom. And the friend was explaining how, you know, the our world is different, and you can't have funerals and you can't have people there, and it's so much going on, and he just felt so bad. And then after he got that news, he found out that a popular DJ Black and Mild died in New Orleans. So he was like, we have to do something. So he called me up, because at the time, I mean, I just started with the Brassaholics, like I'm less than 6 months. So he called me up and he said, we got to do something we can do, you know, I'll Fly Away. And I said, okay, that's cool. So he was like, we want to do it as if we were going to be at a funeral honoring somebody's life. So we want to dress up. So everybody wore suits, and we did the song, and it was meant to send to that, I believe that one person, but you know, we put it on YouTube and it blew up.
When this life is over, I'll fly away to a moon by celestial shore.
You know, the greater, I guess, benefit of that is people, it formed a sense of, I guess, comfort to people who are suffering right now. And I always use this line, I said, music is therapy. So we're going through so much right now with the coronavirus and just life in general, and trying to wrap our heads around what next steps to take. And it's comforting to know that you can listen to a song or play some music, or, you know, just release for a moment with this song, and especially those who are hurting from people who have died during the coronavirus and all that we're dealing with COVID-19.
You can keep up with Mechadibia by following him on Instagram and YouTube under the handle Mechanotes. That's MECCANOTES. And that's all for this week. Our reporting is always online at thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting behind the lens.
Celestial shore, I'll fly away.